Good evening. We are back in session at 6 o'clock or so on March 10th, 2014. We're going to begin with Minnesota Stroke Registry Program Hospital's participation requirement. Justin Bell here and Twyla? Okay.
Senator Sharon.
Good evening. Thank you very much for taking time this evening on Senate File 2261. I would like to be clear that what we're talking about here is just some technical cleanup bill to clarify primary and comprehensive stroke center designation from last year and to give a brief sort of description of what the objective of this technical bill. I would like to introduce Justin Bell, from the Government Relations Director of the American Heart Association.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Justin Bell with the American Heart Association. We're here to talk about Senator Sharon's bill that does a little bit of clarification on a bill that we worked on last year around designating primary and comprehensive stroke centers in Minnesota. What this bill does is adds the requirement for hospitals that choose to apply for primary stroke center status, they would be required to participate in the Minnesota Stroke Registry Program. That's a program that's been operating out of the Department of Health for about 7 years now. There are 16 hospitals that fit this criteria. They all already participate or will be coming back on soon within the next several months. Occasionally, hospitals drop in and out of the program, for example, if they have a staffing change. And when that happens, we have inconsistent data being reported. So the goal of this bill is just to make sure that we have consistent reporting for those hospitals. It's important to note that no hospital has to participate in the system or the registry, but those who choose to apply are expected to participate in the registry.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Are there any questions for Mr. Bell? So if they do choose to participate and they are in the registry program, then they need to do so on a consistent basis. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. That's correct. The bill just ensures that those hospitals that are applying to and choose to apply for designation from the department participate regularly in the stroke program. And just a note about the registry program, it's aggregate data. There's no personal identifiable data. There's no personal identifiers in the data at all.
Okay, thank you. I have listed another testifier, Twyla Brace. Is she present? Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate File 2261? Seeing no one, are there any other questions? Or Senator Sharon, do you have any other final comments?
I'd be happy to move Senate File 2261 be passed and considered for inclusion in our omnibus bill.
So Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 2261 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus policy bill. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Wow. Thank you there. I better restate it just because she didn't say policy and I didn't know.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Where's Egan? It's faster.
Bill is Senator Eakin's 2262, Elevation Myocardial Infarct Registry. So Senator Eakin is not here, so would you like to proceed? Let's begin then with Senate File 1900, Senator Eaton. This is Steve's Law, Drug and Alcohol Overdose Prevention and Medical Assistance Authorization. Thank you.
Senator Sharon, I have Senate File 1900, Administration of Opiate Antagonists. This bill, the part that I believe is relevant to Health and Human Services Committee, is on making the availability of naloxone more, making naloxone more available. The immunity Good Samaritan piece, I believe, will be in Judiciary, unless you disagree. That was my thoughts. So this would allow individuals to administer opiate antagonists and limits liability for those who act in good faith. But the piece for here would be Section 1, which permits licensed prescribers to authorize individuals to administer opiate antagonists. Naloxone or Narcan specifically is what I'm talking about. So it would be an emergency medical responder, a peace officer, a staff of a community-based health disease prevention or social service program, and it also provides individuals who get training, lay people, to be able to do so if the prescriber issues a standing order and has entered into a protocol with the individual, and they've been trained to recognize the signs of opiate overdose. I'm going to let Sheriff Stanek testify so he can go.
Did you want Sheriff Stanek to begin now?
Unless there are questions of me specifically.
No, why don't we? There are no amendments or anything at this time. Okay, well, thank you. Welcome, Sheriff Stanek, to the committee. Would you introduce yourself with your voice and proceed with your testimony?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Madam Chair, members, my name is Rich Stanek. I'm the Sheriff of Hennepin County. I'm also here tonight, Madam Chair, members, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association, collectively representing sheriffs across Minnesota. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak tonight at this committee hearing about this important public safety issue, an issue near and dear to the hearts of Minnesota sheriffs. I also want to thank my friend and, as I say, my hero, Senator Eaton, for her courage and leadership in bringing this issue forward. You know, Senator Eaton and I stood upstairs at the Capitol just a couple of months ago, along with our friends from the Steve Remler Hope Foundation. Many of them are seated behind us in the audience, Madam Chair, and held a press conference where we talked about our efforts to move a bill this coming session. And at that time, you know, truly it was just an idea, but we've been able to put it on paper and move it forward to this process. And I'm very pleased, Madam Chair, members, to be here to speak in support of Senate File 1900. And I also should mention that I want to keep my comments to the health policy aspects of this bill. As Senator Eaton just pointed out, law enforcement does have some concerns with the immunity provisions, but I know that Senator Eaton and her colleagues are working hard to figure those out to some mutual satisfaction before it moves on to Judiciary. Members, as you may know, we're seeing a heroin epidemic nationwide and, you know, right back home in Hennepin County. The statistics are nothing short of alarming. And according to the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, over 50 people die each day in the United States from an opiate-based overdose, including prescription drugs and heroin. You know, last year alone in Hennepin County, we had 56 deaths caused by an overdose to heroin. That's a 51% increase over 2012 and an 833% increase since 2007 when we first started tracking it. You look at this poster board, it gives you a pretty good idea. We first started talking about it in law enforcement when we saw a number of overdose deaths across our county back in 2010, where we had 8. Now, last year, we had 56. I looked at the numbers just this morning, Madam Chair, members. Hennepin County's had 9 heroin overdose deaths since the first 2 months of this year versus 3 this same time period last year. So exponential increases. The trend, like I said, doesn't appear to be slowing. In addition to the deaths, we're also seeing a huge increase in emergency room visits as well. In 2013, there were 63 emergency room visits for heroin exposure compared to just 48 in the prior year, a 32% increase. And most of today's heroin users don't start out as heroin users, but rather approximately 4 out of 5 or 80% of them previously abused painkillers. These painkillers may have been prescribed by a doctor for severe pain management after knee injury, back injury, etc. you know, once that prescription runs out, though, Madam Chair, members, people are turning to heroin. And I got asked this question in the last committee, and I'll just tell you right straight up. They're turning to it because of the availability, the purity, and the price all make it attractive. Let me talk to you just for a few minutes about heroin itself. Yeah, I took the liberty, Madam Chair, members, of bringing a little show and tell and display for you because I wanted you to see what it looked like. I wanted to bring it life and make it real for you. I checked this out from our evidence room, and I brought Deputy Myrie with me, and so it makes it back to where it came from. The value of this, just this little display right here, is about $60,000 street value. I'm going to give you a chance to pass it on your committee. Take a look at it, because one of the things we've done with parents and educators and young people is help educate them about what heroin looks like, what it, you know, what shapes and sizes it comes with, how it's packaged on the street for sale, how easy and readily available it is to people across my county and across the state. So I will give this to Shane. You want to just you can take it up over there, but he's going to make sure, Madam Chair, that we get that that back.
Thank you.
You know, as you take a look at this this display I brought, keep in mind that, like I said, it comes in a variety of colors and in forms of black tar, which is like putty. That white powder is gray or brown powder. It also looks like dirt or even small rocks. It can be injected, snorted, smoked, and ingested. Now, keep in mind, that's a big difference from where it was 25 years ago when the primary way of using heroin was through injection on a needle after heating it up and getting into a liquefied form. Investigators usually find heroin in very small amounts in balloons or tiny bundles. In the big black bags of black tar heroin, those are about $6,000 each on the top of that display. Well, one of the little bundles is about a tenth of a gram and could be sold for around $40 on the street. No question about it, Madam Chair, members, it's coming from Mexican drug cartels, primarily southern border area. They find a lot of creative ways in getting the drugs across the border. And this past summer, a drug task force found a hidden compartment in the front axle of a car. So a lot of different ways to get it in here. What we can do as law enforcement to combat the rise of heroin and prevent these overdose deaths is really simple, and that's why we went to visit with Senator Eaton several months ago. We've been working hard on ways to raise public awareness of this epidemic so that we can prevent future tragedies from occurring, because the one thing I know for sure is 56 deaths down here, every single one of them is preventable. Tragic, a lot of collateral damage to family, friends, economy, work, employers, but every single one of them are preventable. We've held numerous town halls, press conferences, and even had volunteers out at the Minnesota Great Get-Together called the State Fair to help educate parents and kids about the dangers of heroin and how young people are becoming addicted to heroin through the use of opiate-based prescription drugs. And, Madam Chair, members, we encourage people to dispose of unwanted prescription drugs at 6 drop-off sites across our county. I know other county sheriffs have done likewise in their jurisdictions. In addition to prevention, we must address the issue of preventable deaths due to heroin overdose. And I think that Senate File 1900 gives law enforcement the ability to save lives as a first responder to an overdose emergency by administering naloxone or Narcan. I also took the liberty, Madam Chair, members, of bringing at least what is the packaging for it. It comes as simple as this. And this is what we're asking that this legislation would help us enable first responders to be able to carry. And although naloxone is a prescription drug, it is not a controlled substance and has no abuse potential. And that's really important. It's not a prescription drug, has no abuse potential. It is regularly carried by paramedics on ambulances and area emergency rooms. Current Minnesota law, Madam Chair, members, as you know, does not allow for law enforcement to administer naloxone. Firefighters can carry it only if trained as a paramedic. But I want to make sure my deputies and other law enforcement officers across my county and across the state are equipped with this life-saving drug. Now, we've seen successes with law enforcement use of Narcan in other jurisdictions across the country, and I brought a couple examples for you as well. In Quincy, Massachusetts, they've seen 188 heroin overdose reversals since 2010. That's 188 lives saved. In Suffolk County, New York, there were 108 reversals, another 108 lives saved just in the past year of 2013. 17 states in the District of Columbia, Minnesota be amongst them, have amended their laws to increase access to naloxone, resulting in over 10,000 overdose reversals just since 2001. Again, with the passage, Madam Chair, members of Senate File 1900, I think we're going to do what we can to greatly reduce the number of heroin overdose deaths in Hennepin County and across this great state of Minnesota. I'm very happy that you gave me a chance to testify tonight. I'll tell you what I know based on my 30 years of experience as a law enforcement officer, and I'm happy to take questions when the time arises.
Thank you, Sheriff Stanek. I think I might ask right now if there are any questions for Sheriff Stanek. We have others listed here who would like to testify, and I will invite them up. But if there's a question at this time, otherwise I hope you can stay, and there may be some that emerge later. Looks like we're okay for now. So thank you, Sheriff. Dr. Charles Reznikoff. He'll be followed by Cody Weiberg. If you'd like to come right away, Cody helps us move things along, and then that'll be followed by Lexi Reed Holtum.
Thank you, everyone, for your attention. Thank you, Madam Chair, for having me. Thank you for being involved in the bill. My name is Charlie Reznikoff. I work at Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm a general internal medicine doctor. You know, I need to speak up, okay? I'm a general internal medicine doctor, and I'm also an addiction medicine doctor. And I'm really honored to be here today. I have a few comments, and then I want to be available for questions as well. And many people are here today because of death, because they've had a friend or family member who tragically overdosed and died. Some people behind me have experienced that. And I'm actually, if anything, here today because of life, because part of my job is working with addicts who get sober. And what I see and what I can testify to is that heroin addicts can get sober and go back to a life that you and I would recognize as normal. Family members, family work, just normal social interactions. It's not easy, but it happens. And the most fulfilling part of my job is seeing these folks get back to a relatively normal life. So this is really about giving those people a chance, getting them past the crisis so they have a chance of getting back to that normal life. So I want to say a few words about what an active heroin addict may be experiencing, and then a comment on pain pills, and then I'll conclude. As far as an active heroin addict, early on, it's about getting high. I mean, a lot of people, they get high, and it's a feeling of euphoria, and it's a feeling of relaxation and safety. But as the addiction progresses, it becomes using to feel normal again. And there's less high, and there's less euphoria, and there's more desperate avoidance of withdrawal. It's like having a new daily appetite that they're hustling every day to try to feed this appetite. It's not fun anymore. What happens with the overdoses is a batch of heroin is stronger than they expected, or they've mixed in alcohol, or some other instance has happened that has caught them off guard, and they inject or smoke more than they thought they were going to. Sometimes the worst and most tragic overdoses happen when someone's trying really hard to be sober, and they go 2 weeks or 4 weeks of sobriety time, and they lose their tolerance to the drug, and they relapse once. And that first relapse after sobriety is often the one that kills them, the loss of tolerance. So either an unexpectedly strong batch, or sometimes it's those working hardest to be sober that are most vulnerable because they lose their tolerance to the drug. When one were to take Narcan, no one gives themselves Narcan, right? Because if they are able to administer Narcan to themselves, they wouldn't need it. It's only after they are basically comatose that you would get Narcan. So it's always someone else who observes them, like a first responder, or another trained individual, a lay person who's trained. When someone is given Narcan, it jolts them into reality in an incredibly uncomfortable way for them. It's like the whole body pain and excruciating and a panic attack all wrapped up into one, hitting you in 5 minutes. It's not fun. And no one would do this to anyone lightly. I've done this to people. I've seen it happen. They wake up often screaming and angry. Why did you do that? And then you tell them, I saved your life. And then we can deal with it later. The Narcan buys 45 minutes to an hour where it blocks the heroine's activity, and it's an antidote and wakes them up. And it gives them time to then seek help, emergency room help, or seek help otherwise. And it may hopefully be a wake-up call, honestly. Hopefully that's their rock bottom, and then they realize that there's something valuable in life. So those are some comments about addiction and heroin use. I want to make another comment about non-addicts, because we have to – this is not just for addicts. This is for non-addicts. This is for people in pain. Opiate overdoses, which is heroin plus pain pills, opiate collective opiate overdoses, have two peaks. One is 20-year-olds, heroin addicts, right? Or 20 and 30-year-olds, young people using recreational drugs. The other peak of opiate deaths is 50 and 60-year-olds. And they're not recreational heroin users, usually. They're aging, sick folks with emphysema, breathing problems, heart problems, who are on pain pills. And they accidentally overdose. And they're not necessarily addicted. I'm sort of making stereotypes here. In the last 2 weeks, I've been on the general medicine service at Hennepin County Medical Center, not an addictive service, a general service. And in the last 2 weeks, I've seen two older adults, one male, one female, one in the late 50s, one in her mid-60s, who got a little kidney failure from dehydration. They just got dehydrated. Their kidneys stopped filtering as well. And because of that, the pain meds that they were taking as prescribed normally, legally, built up in their system and caused them to stop breathing normally. Both of those folks got to the emergency room okay. Both of those folks are fine. But in the last 2 weeks, I've seen two non-addicts get into trouble with pain pills because of kidney problems. So this isn't just a tool for addicts, it's going to save lives. It's going to save addicts' lives, and it's going to give them a chance to get into recovery. This is also a tool for those in pain and the family members of those in pain so that they can be more safe on their medications. It's a useful tool. And docs, I'll end with this. Docs don't hesitate to prescribe the antidote to insulin to diabetics, and they don't hesitate to prescribe the antidote to bee stings for those allergic to bee stings. Docs wouldn't hesitate to attach one of those AEDs that are in airplanes and sports arenas and malls to someone and shock them if they had a cardiac arrest. But docs still hesitate to do this. And this law will really help docs take the next step to make this life-saving treatment available to people on opioids legitimately or illegally. So thank you very much for your attention, and we can take questions now or later.
Thank you, Dr. Reznikoff. Are there any questions for Dr. Reznikoff at this time? Mr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cody Weiberg. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. And here, basically, I could almost just say everything that Dr. Reznikoff said, ditto. But I'll add a little bit more to that. The first thing I want to do is express the Board of Pharmacy's support for this legislation, for Section 1 of the legislation, which is under discussion today, which is making naloxone or Narcan more widely available. Ms. Reed-Holtham and others from the Rumler Foundation presented at the Board of Pharmacy at one of its meetings last fall, and the board did go on record as supporting this legislation, and then I actually helped craft the language in Section 1, which will make it more this drug more widely available. The other thing I wanted to add is that this particular medication is a very safe medication. It's been used for a very long period of time. And if you give naloxone to somebody who is not having an opiate overdose, essentially nothing happens to them. It just doesn't have adverse effects. So this is a safe medication to use. The third thing I just want to mention is, like Dr. Reznikoff, I've actually seen this work. As it happens, I worked my way through college and pharmacy school as a ward clerk in the university emergency room. And then my first job out of pharmacy school was as a poison information specialist for the Hennepin Regional Poison Center, and we went upstairs all the time for all the overdoses. So I've actually seen people who have had overdoses very quickly respond to this, and it is definitely a life-saving medication. So, and that's really all I have, and I'd be happy to answer questions as well.
Is it injected into the directly into the veins? How is it administered?
Madam Chair, and, members of the committee, there's actually a couple of different ways it can be injected intravenously. There's also a preparation that is used, at least in some states, where it is applied intranasally.
Okay, and you mentioned in the bill here that that the prescribing, that the licensed physician or prescriber can authorize the following individuals to administer opioid antagonists, and one of the requirements is that they, of course, be trained to do that. And correct. But there's not really any discussion about what that training is. Is that necessary here? What can, especially later in the immunity section, I'm sure there'll be questions about what training is occurring for the persons who are authorized by physicians to do this.
Madam Chair.
Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really not overly difficult to spray a medication up somebody's nose who's unconscious, and to know that you should get them to the emergency room within the next 45 minutes. That's essentially what the training is, and to know that...
Excuse me, Senator. Is that the method that we're talking about here? Is that the method by which this medication would be delivered by non-licensed healthcare providers?
It would be the form that I'm guessing most people would select rather than injecting, but they could also do it in... my understanding is they can do it like in an EpiPen type system, like you use for a bee sting, that are set up for a certain dose, and that you would just do in an emergency anywhere, really.
So you're saying that you do not believe that something ought to be said about what this means. Individual has training in the recognition of signs of opioid overdose and use of opioid antagonists.
I think it's very minimal what would be needed. The biggest concern, most people who would have access to the naloxone would have a pretty good idea of what the person was doing, I would assume. And they would, if somebody's unconscious, you can do no harm by going on the safe side and giving the naloxone. Mm-hmm. If they don't have narcotics on board, it won't really have any effect. And
I just want to make sure that they know how to administer it so it does have its proper effect. There's not any complications to that.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it's like anything that you get from the pharmacy. You know, like aspirin, take 2 tablets every 4 hours. You know, as needed. I mean, I'm sure it would have basic instructions on it. My concern would be the emphasis with the getting help, getting to the emergency room, because the narcotics can last longer than the naloxone, and the person could stop breathing again.
Dr. Reznikoff, did you want to speak to what I'm... people are thinking you're leaning forward to looking like you want to say something, so I'm just going to check.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I always want to say something. Oh. It's one of sort of in my constitution. The training is... this has been done in many other states, and the training is standardized. So there's very... as the senator said, it's actually very simple, but it's also been... there's sort of universal, well-known training, and it is recognizing a few signs of opiate overdose administering the medication, and you can just inject it into their skin, or you can squirt it up their nose. The injected into their skin is like, you, as you were alluding to, the EpiPen. So inject it into the skin or squirt it up the nose and call for help. Some of the training involves, some of the subtle points of the training involves how long it takes to take effect. It doesn't happen in 30 seconds. It may take 5 minutes. But the training is standardized, and that information is out there, and we would use the same
Thank you. That answers the question. Okay, great. Lexi Reed Holtram.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for having me here today. So I'm going to keep it kind of short, and feel free to ask any questions that you feel are helpful. My name is Lexi Reed Holtam. I am Vice President of the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation. I'm also Chair of the coalition that's supporting Senator Eaton in bringing this legislation before you today. Many of those members are here with me. All of them are qualified to speak in my replacement. So I just wanted to acknowledge that if you needed more information, you could speak to any of the people behind me who have purple on in any way or fashion. You might maybe not want to ask my 11-year-old who's here too, because she might be a little bit overwhelmed by too many questions. So Steve was my fiancé. He was also my first love in high school and college. What I can tell you about Steve was that he was pretty much a golden boy. I mean, he really was highly educated. He was loved. He came from an exceptional family that thrived. He had a large extended family. He was a top financial planner in the state. We grew up in Edina. We were privileged, and graduated from the University of Minnesota. And what happened to Steve was that he had an injury in 1997. And that injury left him with spinal pain. And that pain was something that he lived with every single day, in waves that slowly started to take away his life. Steve had some of the best. We're in Minnesota. We've got some of the best healthcare in the nation, and he had some very exceptional doctors. About 7-8 years into his chronic pain, his doctors decided to prescribe him opioids. At that point, it was kind of like a magic bullet for Steve. It was the first time in many, many years that he was actually able to get through a day without pain. So for him, that was all of a sudden the solution. Nothing else was the solution after that. He was on opioids at increasing doses and more medication for years, about 5 years. And somewhere in the middle of those 5 years, he actually developed dependency and then slipped into the disease of addiction. Once Steve became addicted, he started to have exhibit behavior that Dr. Reznikoff talked about, where the primary thing for him was to not go into withdrawal. So to be able to effectively do that, he doctor shopped, and he found a doctor that was willing to prescribe him anything that he wanted in any quantity that he wanted. Once he was working with this doctor, he then quickly became less and less of himself and more isolated and unable to fulfill on just the daily joys in life. And thereafter, his family and I and friends went to him and asked him to seek treatment, which he did. And he completed treatment at one of the best facilities that we have in our nation and did a 28-day program, which I won't go into, but that's not enough time. And thank goodness for parity, and I'll leave it at that. So for Steve, then, he got out of treatment, and very shortly after, he relapsed. At this time, hydrocodone combination products were Schedule 3. He had refills. He then used his refills, went through them, and 45 days after treatment, or 44 days after treatment, had met somebody in this process, in his journey. He had met somebody that could get him street heroin. And I am a layperson, and for me, I feel like I can qualify street heroin as street heroin because, really, frankly, hydrocodone combination products, they're pretty much the same thing in my mind. They have they're opium, which is what heroin comes from as well, and it is a outrageous problem that we have with the prescription pill prescribing practices in our country today. And so for Steve, he found somebody that could get him street heroin. He took heroin one time and overdosed and died. What we know to be true is that there were people there with him. Also, what I believe to be true is, had what Dr. Reznikoff stated been true, that doctors weren't afraid to prescribe, if this law had been in place, then doctors would have given him the antidote because he was using a dangerous drug, where there should be the ability for family and friends to have the antidote if somebody accidentally takes too much, even if they're using their medicine as prescribed, which wasn't Steve's case in the end. As our friend Sheriff Stanek has already stated, 17 other states have already implemented a naloxone law. We have seen no negative consequences from this. As Cody Weiberg, our friend, also has also stated, there's no abuse potential for this drug. It is 100% safe, and we have the support from DHS, MDH, ACP, MMA, Poison Control, the VCCC for this part of the bill, the Coalition of Recovery Investment, and the Minnesota AIDS Project. So I ask you today to move this bill forward, and I thank you for your time. And if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you very much, Ms. Holtum. Are there any questions at this time?
I'd just like to...
Senator Eakin.
Thank you. Most of you know my story in that my daughter overdosed from heroin in 2007. I believe in personal responsibility. She went out of her way to obtain heroin. The guy delivered it to her car, dropped it off in the center council, and grabbed the 20 on the council, and her and a friend used it. He did not overdose, but she did. He was more concerned about this was not the person who delivered it. It was the person who was just with her. He did not worry so much about whether she was going to survive or not. He was more concerned about keeping from getting arrested. So he spent a considerable amount of time stashing all the paraphernalia and any evidence in the bottom of a garbage can in the fast food restaurant that they were in the parking lot of. And then he went back and was trying to wake her, and her story's in there. It's Arielle Eaton Wilson. And was unable to rouse her, and he was making enough commotion that the manager of the restaurant saw that and flagged down a police officer going through the drive-through, who then went over to the car to check it out, and he denied what he knew what was wrong with her. All of this... You know, it was over 30 minutes that passed, and the police officer did start to try to do life-saving techniques and called for the EMTs, but by the time she got naloxone, we figure it was a good 40 minutes, and it was too late. She did not come back, and she had many doses. It was. I believe that this young man would have called for help immediately if he knew that he wouldn't be prosecuted. I believe that if they'd have had access to naloxone, he would have used it. You know, I believe there is a possibility if he would have told the police officer what was going on and she had naloxone on her, she could have saved her life. It's really a simple fix. It's a no-brainer, and it could save lots of lives. And I do want to point out also that there is immunity for the health professional who prescribes the standing order for the medication and the person who in good faith administers it, so in this bill.
Thank you, Senator Eakin, for your stories, both of you for your stories. All right, any questions? Seeing none. Senator Eakin, you can move. Senator Eaton, I always call you Senator Eakin, who's coming up next. Senator Eaton, as if I don't know your name, is moving Senate File 1900. Your motion, Senator, is that it be referred to the Judiciary. Pass and be referred to Judiciary.
Yes.
And that's Senator Eaton's motion. Although, any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Thank you. Thank you very much for this important testimony. Prevails. Okay, now Senator Eaton. Senator Eakin is presenting. He's been patiently waiting in the back. I saw him. Is he there? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Welcome, Senator Eakin, Senate File 2262.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this piece of legislation is part of a much larger picture. It's creating a comprehensive system for treating the most deadly heart attack, which is known as the STEMI. It's commonly referred to as the Widowmaker because of how deadly it is. When a STEMI strikes, a patient needs to be rapidly transported to a facility that's capable of opening up blocked artery, and that's what a STEMI is almost a complete blockage of the main artery. Time is the biggest obstacle to success here, particularly in rural Minnesota where we have great distances to travel to get to the hospitals. Transport time oftentimes eats into the precious minutes between life and death. The American Heart Association in Minnesota has launched something known as Mission Lifeline, which is a large-scale program that focuses on rural STEMI patients. It increases the number of patients who receive life-saving treatment in time. In 2013, the American Heart Association secured a $6.5 million grant to fund the development of a rural STEMI system for Minnesota. The first phase has been granting money directly to rural ambulance services and rural hospitals. This bill addresses a crucial piece, which is quality improvement and analysis. Data is collected from participating rural hospitals and centers, PCI centers, from first medical contact through the patient discharge in order to evaluate how the system is working. Senate File 2262 creates a STEMI registry at the Department of Health to receive the data already being voluntarily collected in order to analyze it and report for quality improvement assessments. So I think it's important to note that no personal health identifiers are collected here. This is all in the aggregate. No individual case data is reported. No single hospital is identified. No hospitals are required to participate under this bill either. It's strictly voluntary. So this data is already being voluntarily collected, and the bill only provides a method for the analysis and reporting of a statewide picture. What this registry does is it shows how we are doing and where we can focus efforts to improve, and that's what Senate File 2262 does. In your packets, you'll also have letters from regional EMS directors in support of this bill. And I do have with me today two testifiers, Richard Mulvane, who's going to speak as to why the registry is important, and Mindy Cook, who's an RN that's director of the Mission Line, who's going to talk about how the registry works, how this specific registry works. So with that, I'd like to introduce, I guess, Richard first.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you for having me here today. My name is Richard Mulvane. I'm a clinical pharmacist by training. I grew up here in the Twin Cities area, and I went to Richfield High School, and then I spent my training down at the University of Minnesota, and I worked downtown. And then when I graduated from college, I moved up north to the Duluth area. So I moved from an urban to a rural setting. And that's what's really exciting about this is over 20 years later, my training has ended up pushing me into a position of being in charge of the heart attack program for Essentia Health in Duluth, Minnesota. And as a pharmacist, too, I'm also a board-certified pharmacotherapy specialist, and I'm the first pharmacist in the state of Minnesota to achieve added qualifications in cardiology, and which suits me nice because I actually work for a cardiology group now. And I have been working with heart attack care for quite some time, and the concept of a registry, I'm sure you're familiar, is where we, you know, dump information on how we take care of patients to see what is working and what is not. And we do practice evidence-based medicine to the best of our ability. And I'm also familiar with the prior registry to the one that we're talking about tonight. There was the Crusade Registry, which was for the less serious types of heart attacks, and then the NERMI, which was for other types, and this new action registry, which we've been participating in for, I believe, over 3 years now, is a combination to put all that heart attack care together. Well, so focusing more specifically on this registry, why is this registry important to our STEMI system of care? Again, I've been the STEMI system manager for almost 6 years, and we've done a really good job across the country, and especially here in Minnesota, at the large hospitals that receive the heart attack patients. We do a great job once we know you're coming and get you up to the cath lab and we can go in and open up that blocked artery really fast. But it doesn't do a lot of good to open it up fast once you get to our institution. And if you spend all that time out in the woods or out in a rural area, unable to get that attention while every second or minute that goes by, heart muscle is dying. And so the opportunity to really make a huge difference in improving mortality, morbidity, and outcomes for heart attack care in the country and specifically here in rural Minnesota is to work on the rural areas of getting people to reperfusion faster. And the registry that we're using actually takes a look at the whole system of care. It isn't just about my hospital or the hospital next door. It's about from the time that that patient starts having symptoms to when they call 911 to the first, maybe at first responders, basic life support gets there. They recognize a problem, and then an advanced life support system gets there. And with the grant, we're excited that now with more EKG equipment, if they recognize this heart attack in the field, then we can launch a helicopter that could be intercepting them somewhere or get them to the hospital where they need the treatment. Well, again, we've been collecting information for quite some time, but what's really novel about this legislation, for SF-2262, is that it's unique in the sense that we're collecting this pre-hospital, stuff that happens, you know, from the house to the ambulance services before they get to our hospital. Whereas currently, you know, CMS, Joint Commission, and other accrediting bodies, we don't really submit that data, if you will, on what happens before they get to our hospital or like hospitals. So again, the novelty of this is if we really want to move the needle to improve mortality, morbidity for heart attack care, it's about improving the system of care out there in the field, and specifically in rural Minnesota is where we have the greatest opportunity. So that's why I'm excited to be a part of this project. Oh, in addition to my role at Essentia, I'm also the co-chair for this three-year project through the American Heart Association for Mission Lifeline. So I'm kind of vested interest from that angle as well. At this point, I'll open it up to any questions or comments and hand it off to our next person.
Thank you very much. Are you Mindy Cook?
I am.
Would you like to begin your testimony now?
Sure, I'll begin. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for having me here today. My name is Mindy Cook. I work with the American Heart Association as the director for Mission Lifeline in North Dakota and Minnesota. I've been in this role for just over 2.5 years, and I've been able to be a part of the North Dakota implementation of a similar program to improve rural STEMI systems of care. Prior to this, I come from a clinical nursing background, and I had 12 years of cardiovascular care nursing experience. I am currently a resident of rural Minnesota, and I have family on both sides in both states that are affected and by these systems of care. And so it is my passion, and thank you for inviting me here today. I'm going to talk very briefly about how the registry works and try to keep it as simple as I can. So we have a number of hospitals participating in this data collection through this Rural Minnesota Project and the North Dakota Project. It is a voluntary process that they would sign up for to participate in the registry, which we are supporting through these grants. Data is abstracted by each individual hospital by one of their trained employees. There are about 230 data points that track those patient metrics throughout their stay. The data collection starts with the time of their symptom onset through their pre-hospital care with emergency medical services and at a referring hospital if they stop at one that does not have capabilities to open that artery directly through their final treatment, usually at a receiving center where they are treated with angioplasty and stenting. And so it does capture the full spectrum of care. It is a quality improvement registry. So the focus is for it to be a tool for individual hospitals to use internally and within their STEMI networks to improve all the elements of that survival. It is an observational data collection, so there is no direct patient contact with the patients to ask them additional questions. It is just abstracted from the existing medical record that the patient goes through the course in the hospital with. Privacy is maintained through a series of encryption and passwords, and it is a HIPAA-compliant database. We co-administer this grant with the American College of Cardiology, and data is protected through both of those entities. It does offer an opportunity to increase adherence to the guidelines and best practices, which Richard referenced, through on-demand reports, which can be pulled by the hospital on a daily or weekly basis, however often they'd like to pull them, so that they can use it for immediate quality improvement. And there are also quarterly and annual reports. The data is benchmarked against both the state, so all the entities participating in the registry in the state, and then nationally. It also reports risk-adjusted mortality on all of those measures. For example, how we've used some of the aggregated reports in North Dakota is that we identified early on in our first full year of data collection that we had an issue with patients not recognizing their system and seeking medical treatment early. So our patients in North Dakota were waiting about 3 hours to seek treatment. And so we were able to tailor our public awareness campaign through the grant for that measure to try to improve that response on the patient's part of seeking treatment earlier and utilizing the services of the emergency medical services, who are now able to obtain those 12 leads in the field and identify that those patients are having heart attacks. In that time preceding that, we've been able to cut that time to treatment in half in North Dakota as through part of our program and work. Those were all of the points I have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have for me.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions at this time? Are there other testifiers? Seeing no one. Oh, yes, there is. Please approach us and... And if the other testifiers would hang in here with us a little bit, because there may be more questions as we move across. Welcome, Ms. Brace. We've called on you a few times here tonight, but we missed you until now. But please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I think unless you've done the stroke registry one, there was no other bill I was going to be heard on. So
I guess that was it. Yeah, that was it. Thank you.
All right. As an emergency room nurse, I am very concerned about the care of patients, but I think it's important to do the care of patients the right way and not to violate any of their rights along the way. So when... if you look at this bill, we look at the words in line 1.9, which have to do with continuous quality improvement. And I just wanted to read you something that the Hastings Center says about continuous quality improvement in a report that they did about whether QI is research and how it should be treated. So one of the things that they say is ethical issues arise in QI, quality improvement, because attempts to improve the quality of care for some patients may sometimes inadvertently cause harm or may benefit some at the expense of others or may waste scarce healthcare resources. Ethical issues also arise because some activities aimed at improvement have been interpreted as a form of medical research in which the patients are used as subjects. So one of our concerns about this bill is that because this is implementing continuous quality improvement and hospitals might be doing it on their own, which has its own problems when it comes to research, but the fact that we would put in a bill and require this and then go to line 2.1, which I think is especially concerning. And I guess you have to go first to line 1.11, which it says, in implementing the plan, the commissioner shall. And then you get to line 2.1, and it says, require the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines. Now, our question about evidence-based treatment guidelines has always been, who decides what the evidence is? And having done a report on evidence-based guidelines and looked at peer-reviewed studies and found that even researchers doing this kind of research agree that there are different ways to view evidence and that some researchers will pick these people to study or some people will have this question or some people will avoid this. It's a matter of what you study. And so having done a report on evidence-based medicine, I know from peer-reviewed researchers that they themselves disagree. So here when we have a requirement of the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines, then we're concerned that the commissioner decides in some form or fashion what is evidence-based treatment guidelines, and then those are imposed. And as I read from the Hastings report, this could put some patients in danger, because this is essentially research. So there's no consent here for this. There's a lot of data collection. I realize that the data collection doesn't identify the individuals, but that doesn't mean that people who are being part of a research project in the data collection would necessarily like to be part of this. So our basically we have two concerns. One, that this is a research project. Three. One, that this is a research project. Two, that there's no consent by all the patients who are part of a research project as a result of being in this treatment situation. And then third, that the commissioner will require the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines that may or may not work for that individual and therefore, as the Hastings report said, may or may not put individuals in a place of harm. And I think that this is precedent-setting legislation, because it makes me concerned about the next thing where the commissioner will have the power to impose evidence-based treatment guidelines. Will it be asthma, diabetes? What will it be? And what we're looking at here are individual patients who are as different as you and I, right down to their DNA. And it's a fine thing to propose ideas, to have them out there, but individuals need to be treated as individuals and not as subjects for research.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Eakin, would you talk? There are three components here of question about it being, we're acknowledging that research, there's research capacity in the data collection, but the data itself does not have personal information about it. So it's the challenge is here is whether or not you want to do that. And if you get by that, then the other issue is that the person is involved, even though the data, personal data, is excluded without their knowing they're part of a research project. And is there harm in that data collection process if the person's not aware that it's about them and their data isn't identified? So that's two. But then there's the third, which authorizes, or that the Commissioner of Health shall establish and implement a plan for continuous quality improvement, and then on 2.15, require the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines. To whom are those being required to be? Who's being required? What happens if they don't, or what is that all about?
Well, Madam Chair, as I read it again, it does say guidelines, which implies that these are not something being imposed. They are guidelines, which means it's more suggesting that these are the methods that are the most appropriate, most effective. But again, they are guidelines, so I don't see this as an imposition as much as it is more suggestions based on evidence-based research. And again, in the other concerns that you'd that have been mentioned.
Before you leave that to the other concerns, it's unclear to me who's being require the application of evidence-based treatment guidelines regarding the transitioning of patients to community-based follow-up care in hospital, outpatient, physician office, and ambulatory clinic settings for ongoing care. Who's being required? The physician that's discharging the patient is being required to apply these guidelines? And why wouldn't it be, instead of require, why wouldn't you say encourage? Anyway, just you can fool around with that a little bit if you want to.
Sure. And Madam Chair, I don't know if there's others that could provide more information as to who actually is being required to apply these evidence-based guidelines.
Madam Chair, Richard Mulvaney here. Looking at line 2.1, required application of evidence-based medicine for patients transitioning, as far as I understand, this is after the patient has been treated and discharged home. And our institution, just like others, that is Joint Commission accredited, is required to follow, or is recommended to follow evidence-based therapies that have been shown to save lives for people. For example, if you had a heart attack, we send you home on aspirin, an ACE inhibitor, and a beta blocker, and a statin, and smoking cessation counseling. So there's actually things that we have to do to achieve Joint Commission accreditation to be an accredited hospital. And I'm guessing that that's where this language came from. The evidence is about transitioning them home after they've had the heart attack. And that's the practice of the best practicing institutions that I'm very familiar with, and we've been doing this for many, many years. I don't know if that helps clarify, but this specific line is about transitioning them. So in my understanding is this is what happens after once the patient is being sent home. They're discharged from a hospital. They need to be also encouraged to use evidence-based treatments that have been shown to help people once they've had a heart attack. And we learn what works from registries like the one we're talking about after 1 year, 3 year, 5 years, who lives, who dies, who has a readmission. That's how we learn what works best.
I think what you're saying is that because you can look at that data, you can see when you have had positive outcomes what interventions occurred post-hospitalization most commonly to create a better outcome.
Absolutely. As negative outcomes. For example, we used to, when you were having a heart attack, we would tell everybody, you have to push a beta blocker, like a low pressor, 5 milligrams IV every 5 minutes. Well, then we learned when we were doing this, some people, it would actually cause harm, and it would show it up in registry data. And guidelines changed. That was the evidence to let us alert everyone that, hey, we should quit doing this. Because oftentimes what is intuitive and makes sense, the registries reveal what maybe isn't the best care. And so that's why to reiterate the value of the guidelines we have, a lot of it is driven by things we learn from registries.
You may have answered this, and I may not just get what you're saying, so give me another shot at it, okay? I understand about joint accreditation, and I understand about the process of being reviewed, and one of the things they look at is your discharge materials and content that you provide a person after treating, which is what this would be, I'm assuming, is information to them about what needs to be done post-hospitalization. But in other instances, other than this legislation, are you required to provide certain specific treatment guidelines?
To achieve accreditation or recognition from Joint Commission, and you know, certainly institutions that don't get these accreditations cannot remain financially survivable because they depend on that for their credibility. But it is not mandatory. A guideline is a guideline, like was brought up earlier, and there is some discretion by physicians. But as a whole, the reality is institutions and healthcare in general is graded on performance, and these metrics are some of the exact metrics that we were talking about.
I must not be asking my question very clearly. I don't disagree with guide. I am not one to disagree with research indicating guidelines, best practices, what those discoveries are. But this is a registry bill. It's about registering information, and this one thing sort of sticks out as a requirement for the application of some evidence-based treatment guidelines. That's what's sticking out here. It's very different than the other components of the legislation that have to do with data gathering. So would you look at that again, please? It seems, that the require is the one that, for certain, the requirement. I don't believe the joint accreditation requires that you apply evidence-based treatment guidelines during discharge planning. It probably requires that you do discharge planning and that you have a strategic initiative, but allows that autonomy of the person to indicate based on the unique character of the client what the post-hospitalization treatment should be. Then once they report the data back, is once you got the data, then you can inform, that's where you get to inform this physician or other discharger that this is what we've learned, that if you include this in your discharge plan on this particular situation, you have better outcomes.
Absolutely, and then just the qualifiers are, again, the word require, I think, is the sticking point here, but the other reality is, like, for example, if somebody might be allergic to aspirin, so we don't have to give them an aspirin if we know it's going to cause an allergic reaction. We just have to document why they don't do it. But again, the template is there for what would be the best practice.
Yes.
Sure. This is Justin Bell, I'm the Government Relations Director with the American Heart Association. I think that the sentence may not be structured properly. The requirement isn't necessarily the application of the guideline. The requirement is that the application of any guideline should be evidence-based. So recommendations or requirement of guidelines coming from the commissioner should be based in evidence-based medicine. So
any recommendations coming from the commissioner should be evidence-based is a completely different statement than requiring people to apply. That's why I said, who are we asking to require here to do what? I think that's what the testifier was picking up on.
Correct.
As well.
I think that sentence just might not be structured.
Let's clean that up. We're going to judiciary from here, and I think it will give us a chance to have another look at this, if you wouldn't mind.
Absolutely.
Trying to clean that up. All right. Please come forward while in.
Thank you. I just want to
please reintroduce yourself, Twyla.
Twyla Bray, Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I just want to point out one thing on this form here called Minnesota STEMI Registry, because it goes a bit to my point about guidelines. And actually, if you listen to the man who was sitting here, and I'm sorry, I don't remember his name. But
Mr. Bell.
Here the hospitals were doing something that the registry found to be harming people. So this, our concern is that we get these kind of things out there, and then they are harming people. And, okay, the registry can find out about that harm, right? But why are they pushing it, just one treatment for everybody? So I just want to point out column 4, which is above the map of the United States. And there's one bullet point up there. Encourage use of registries as an efficient data collection tool as part of payment and delivery reform initiatives. And I think, just like he said, they don't have to give the aspirin, but they have to say why they didn't. And that just shows you sort of the power of the protocol. the power of the protocol and how their payment may be judged upon whether or not they followed the protocol, whether or not they told why they didn't. And that's one of our concerns even about these guidelines, is as much as guidelines as they are, if you listen to him having to actually register why he did, why he didn't follow the guideline in order to have it work, I just worry that in this whole process of evidence-based, that we move towards a payment reform that makes it difficult for doctors to actually treat people like individuals.
Thank you. I think that we, I think if I were to restate that, the essence of the concern is that it's the outcomes that really we ought to be concerned about here, and that reimbursement ought to be based on outcomes, not necessarily on the application of a pre-designed set of requirements or guidelines. I understood your essential message. But that's not what's being proposed here. So, but I understand the creep. It's the question of the creep of where we move. Any further discussion on this bill at this time? Okay. We need a motion. Senator Eakin, would you like to make the motion? Which would be?
Senator Eaton.
Senator Eaton. You know, once I get fixed like that, I've got to make an association here. Do you like to eat? and then for Senator Eakin, eek! Right. So now I'm fixed. Okay,
it's a good
those
thing,
are
Madam
terrible.
Chair, that Senator Kent isn't here as well.
Senator Eaton, excuse me. Thank you for your patience with me. Would you move Senator Eakin's bill, Senate File 2262, it's to pass and be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
So moved.
There's a motion. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Passes. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We're done?
So. I guess that we have anything further to come before the committee? Thank you very much. There's things in the back room here for you to eat. I don't want to take them home. Thank you.